So, Berto, this is our 700th episode.
What?
700.
But we just said it was like 600 and something a few months ago.
Yeah, 700 episodes.
What the heck?
How do you feel about that?
700. Like, I don't think I've done 700 of anything in my life.
Yeah.
Wow.
Of nothing? Nothing. You've probably taken a step 700 times.
I don't think so. Well, yeah. But I mean, like, that's a big deal. 700. Imagine if you had written 700 books, or if you had done 700 trips to the moon.
Yeah.
small things like, you know that.
Yeah, it's pretty much analogous to that.
Wow.
The last time we did an episode that highlighted a particular number was at 300.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, which was which was 3 years ago.
That's crazy.
3 years ago we did our...
So we've more than doubled it in less than the time.
Yeah, so when we started doing Patreon and we started actually getting funding to do this thing, it finally freed me up anyway to dedicate a lot more time, and therefore, we've made many more episodes. Yep. So I'm a list maker. I keep track of lots of different things.
Right.
And one of the things that I've kept track of is the amount of hours I've spent on this podcast.
Oh, my God.
And I've spent about 5,500 hours on this podcast.
Wow.
You have spent about 500.
Oh, man.
Hours on this podcast.
Which
sounds like not that much, but, you know.
I mean, 500 hours. Imagine playing a video game for 500 hours.
I mean, yeah. So
most video games, like the games that I remember that felt like I spent a chunk of my life, it was like 100 hours, 120.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, so over 5,000, you know, a typical job full time is like 2,000 hours.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost like 3 years of a full-time job that I did on the side while I had full-time jobs and I was
crazy,
in graduate school.
Dude.
So we will reach 1,000.
600 podcasts.
We'll reach 1,000 in the year 2020 in 2 years.
Whoa.
We'll reach 2,000 in 8 years in the year 2026.
The year
2026. How do you feel about that, reaching the number 2,000?
That seems like we should beat it. Beat it.
So now, I didn't know how to celebrate, so I thought I would just do things around the number 700.
Ooh, like the 700 Club.
Like the 700 Club. So according to Wikipedia, 700 is a natural number following 699 and and preceding 701.
Nah, come on. That's a coincidence.
It's a Harshad number, a.k.a. a Niven number. Do you know what those are?
No.
You wanted to be a mathematics major.
Yeah, I should know what Niven numbers
are. I wanted to be a mathematics major, too, in high school. And then I took, or in college, and then I actually took high math and thought, this is, I get that, you know, I get the usefulness of this, but my God, it's boring. It was just so... I was just like, the only reason why I'd be interested in this is because I want to prove to other people that I get it or something. You know what I mean?
See, I actually loved proofs. Oh, I loved proofs.
Yeah. Well, like calculus up till beyond calculus, when you get into like imagination kinds
love
of
stuff. I love that stuff, man.
I got the creativity and I liked the sort of history because you go back to like, you know, ancient Greeks and their, you know, like the depth that UW high-level math classes required of you, it was so much work, and it was just like, why, you know?
Oh, man. Yeah, you got to love it. That's no question.
So a Harshad number or Niven number is an integer that is divisible by the sum of its digits.
Oh.
So it's I think they call this recreational math or something.
Yeah.
It's not like it's just like fun math.
Right.
So if you add 7 and 0 and 0, you get 7, and therefore it divides into itself. So in the year 700, looked it up in Wikipedia. What do you think happened in the year 700?
Well, let's see. In the year 700, the Roman Empire was
gone.
Gone. Yeah, it was declined.
Except the Byzantines.
Byzantine was going strong, and were the Mongols invading?
Was that around that time? I don't know.
Or was the Huns? No, the Huns were invading.
Yeah, the Mongols were later, right?
Yeah,
they were
the Huns
like
were invading.
1300. Well, I don't know, but the things that I wrote down were Mount Edziza, a volcano in British Columbia, just north of here. Ooh. It erupted.
Holy crap.
So a large, it's actually a volcano complex that erupted in British Columbia, very close to
you don't
to
hear
here.
About that in the mainstream media.
The Wari people invaded and occupied the Cusco Valley in modern Peru.
The Wari?
The Wari people.
Okay.
So they know that because, you know, they kept very good, you know, track of their time. So that's that. And I mean, when you think of the number 700, what do you think of? Like any associations?
Yeah. So seven is a perfect number according to various numerology traditions.
It's a prime.
It's also a prime. But
it's often people's lucky number.
Number seven.
It's a biblical lucky number.
That's right. It's the most common number you can roll when you roll the dice.
Two dice.
When you roll two dice. And when you roll two six-sided dice. Yeah. It was considered, so six was sort of considered an incomplete and therefore sort of the devil's number. But seven was considered complete and God's number.
I wonder why. It's so interesting.
Well, it is interesting. Part of it has to do with the fact that seven is odd, but it's got this thing where you have seven can be the result of 4 plus 3. Seven can be the result of 6 plus 1. Seven is also like if you draw it out, you can make this like the way the configuration of the dots are, right? Like you could have six perfectly arranged dots and then a seven dot in the middle and it forms this like little beautiful pattern. But I also think that there was something to associate with, like in the Bible it mentions 666 as the number of the beast.
Yeah.
And you know, so and who knows, there's probably a ton of like things that you could pick out of, like, well, here they said seven this, seven that, so seven must be God's number.
Well, it's interesting because in the East they have a whole different set of numbers that they consider to be lucky and unlucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like not inherent in human or even in mathematics.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, certainly seven is a prime number, but it's not. In fact, many believe that six and three and nine are glorious numbers, you know, and so it's one of those weird.
Do you have a favorite number?
I 42. No, I actually my favorite number in general is 69.
Why?
It started off somewhat immaturely.
Oh, it is your favorite number.
It is, yeah. And originally, I must admit, it started when I was a teenager.
You never disappoint, Berto.
But what I will say is that I grew to appreciate the symmetry of that number. And first of all, it, you know, if you draw it, it's like it's yin and yang, right? Because you can draw the six and the nine like they're yin and yang.
So yeah.
Yin and yang. And it is, so a little bit of rebellious. If 70 is meant to be a perfect, you know, multiple of seven, the perfect number, I like the fact that it's just one shy of that, you know? Hmm. I also think it's great because the it's divisible by three, and I like numbers that are divisible by three. Mm-hmm. Because,
well, who doesn't?
Well, yeah, well, because three is, I would say, my second favorite number. Mm-hmm. Anytime I'm doing lists or I'm telling you the top end things, I usually go for three. Three is a nice, stable base. Three, and so I feel like the fact that 69 is divisible by three makes it better in my mind, you know? So there's a lot of reasons like that.
Hmm. Well, thank you, patrons, for getting us this far to this boring segment of Psychology in Seattle, which is the name of this podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Berto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I am a clockmaker.
So I thought we would spend this episode just gabbing, just you and me, just kicking back, mm-hmm. talking about random stuff. So listeners out there, if you're wanting some hardcore psychology stuff, I'm actually working on some deep dives that I'll get into next week, but for this week, it's mainly short topics and other kinds of stuff. So I apologize for that in advance.
Yay!
All right. So do you have a gripe, Berto?
I do.
Tell me your gripe.
Okay. So, and I have been guilty of this. So, but it's a lot of my gripes are usually things that I've been guilty of. Let's say you're running late somewhere, right? and you...
I almost never run late.
Yes, but let's say you did. And you show up late. And the people that were waiting for you are like, what happened? And you go, oh, don't even ask me. I don't want to talk about it. You know, like your reaction is to be angry. And
angry at the person who asked you?
Well, angry at something, and you don't even want to talk about it. So it's like you had a little anger and a little crypticness to it. And that's supposed to make it okay. Uh-huh. Right? So for example, like, did you break my mug, my Psychology in Seattle mug? It's like, oh, don't even get me started on that. No, I don't even want to have this conversation. Wait, what? Like that kind of thing. It drives me nuts because you have a perfectly reasonable complaint that this person directly is responsible for.
Yeah.
And not only are they not apologizing, they're turning it around, and whether they're angry at you, or they're angry at something, and they don't even want to talk about it.
And you imagine it's not legitimate?
Oh, it's totally not legitimate. Oh. For example,
it's a smokescreen.
It is a smokescreen. In fact, I know it's a smokescreen because I've done this before. But I remember being in a meeting one time, and it was a whole bunch of us.
It's funny, it would never occur to me to do that, but it would totally work.
Well, it sadly does work, yeah. Depends on
no
the
one wants
context.
To, especially, yeah, if you're in a work meeting, no one in the middle of everyone's going to be like, no, tell us your horrific.
Right.
Because they're going to go, oh, were they at the doctor? Or okay. was it their wife? Or, you know, like what was, you know?
So I was in a meeting many, many years ago. It was a whole bunch of us clockmakers, and we're in a closed room meeting, and the meeting started, say, at 10 a.m. in the morning, right? Like at 10:15, and this is maybe an hour long meeting, but at 10:15, one of us that was supposed to be there at 10 shows up. We all sort of like stop, look. Without a word, this person comes, sits down, and drops their head to the desk on their arms. Whoa. And doesn't say anything.
Sounds a little histrionic.
Oh, yeah. And we're all like, and so no one asks. No one acknowledges. We just continue with the meeting. And the person is like that. Like, I'd like to say almost the entire rest of the meeting.
Do you think that person wanted someone to pay attention to them?
I could imagine. But I couldn't tell if it was like they're doing this because they don't want to say... They know they're super late.
Or
they don't want to acknowledge it.
Or they're legitimately suffering from something horrible.
I would have bought that if I didn't know the drama level that this person
source, okay.
Yeah. And so, but this has happened, you know, so many times. I will say for me, usually when I've done it, it is because I was, and the way it usually played, and I don't do it anymore as much, but it usually was like this. I was running late to my therapy in Seattle, my psychotherapy. And it was usually because of traffic, but honestly, it's because I left too late and there was bad traffic, right? And I would get there, and it was like an hour session, and I would get there like 10 minutes late, and I would come in, and rather than just be like, I'm so sorry, this happens too frequently, I really need to just change my mind about how soon it is that I think that I need to leave, right? Instead, I'd walk in, and I'd be like, oh my God, Seattle traffic is the worst. I swear, I might have to move out of the city. And what was great is my therapist would not take the bait. You know, she'd be like, wow, you seem really angry about this. Why do you think you're so angry? And I'd be like, no, it's not, like, this is always the case. Like, this is just so bad. It's like, but what's happening right now? Let's talk about what's happening right now. I'm like, no, nothing's happening. It's just so terrible. You know, and it was so, so great. It took me several of these where I was like, oh, and by the way, at the time, you know what I was doing? Back then, I would remember we were talking in another episode about Laura Ingraham or Dr. Laura and
Schlesinger.
Yeah, and then the Michael or was the show that's not by convicted wackos. No,
yeah,
right. Okay, but at the time, I was also listening to Michael Medved and Michael Abrash and Rush Limbaugh and all these things, and to quote unquote research the other side or whatever. But it would drive me so batty and upset. And so it was the double whammy. I'd be like, oh, and on top of that, I was listening to the radio. And oh, my God, they were talking about the most stupid thing. And then she was just like, wow. And then I remember when she connected it for me, she was like, so you've told me about your father and how he used to like yell at the television. And I was like, it was just a really interesting thing. But I used to do that. I used to deflect. So instead of just acknowledging what had happened and
that,
trying
that,
to
that you're late,
that I'm late, and that it and is that under my control.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were worried about disapproval from your therapist.
Yeah, I didn't even consider that. But yeah, yeah.
And you were defending by.
Right,
by
exactly.
Being angry and
exactly.
And maybe even a little entertaining with your anger.
Absolutely. But it was never angry at her. It was angry at some other thing. Yeah. The thing that made me late. I'm a victim. I am a victim.
Interesting.
So, but that is one of my gripes of wrath.
Well, we always hate the things that we do.
Yes.
So my gripe is about Cortana and about people who claim that Siri always works so well.
You don't like the Halo games? What's wrong with you?
I love the Halo games. I actually... about a year ago bought on Xbox Live or whatever
the Master Chief Collection
all 5 digital and proceeded to go back through every single episode every single version back to back which was amazing cuz I actually played each Halo game as they came out it was a few years between each one and it was amazing that actually, in my head, I was like, one was really fun, and then maybe 4 was okay. Actually, all of them are great games.
Yeah,
was it 5 that I got to there was one of them where it was like the gameplay was a little annoying.
Are you thinking of ODST?
Well, no, I hated that one.
Yeah.
I didn't even try to replay it.
Well, for me, I've never played 5. So I can't comment on that one. I didn't care for 4, honestly.
Was 4 the one where you're doing a lot of long-range firing?
Yeah, and it's got the little Prometheans that dissolve into little fireflies.
Yeah.
I didn't like that one.
I think that was okay. Anyway, my point is that, in fact, I know Cortana. I grew up with the woman, Jennifer.
Right.
Jenny Taylor. In fact, I was just looking through my old... videos that my dad took of me in high school and stuff, and there's plenty of
plenty of Cortana.
Yeah, she grew up just like a block away from me, and
yeah.
My sister was like best friends with her sister. Like, nice. So me and Cortana, the real person, go way back. But anyway, I got a new laptop and it has Windows on it, and there's just a ton of Cortana in it.
Features, yeah.
Yeah, that you have to slowly turn off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, no, I don't want to talk to my laptop. You know what I mean? And 2, it never works. Like, I have a Pixel phone that is made by Google.
Yeah.
And the OK Google thing is supposed to work.
Right.
It works 10% of the time.
Right.
And so it's like, but even if it worked only 90% of the time, I still wouldn't use it. Because what if your mouse only worked 90% of the time?
Right.
What if your car... only got you to work 90%. You'd be like, no,
that's unacceptable.
I'll do some other mode.
Yeah,
of course. So it's like, because I don't want to, because the 10% of the, or whatever percent of the time that Siri or OK Google or Cortana or Amazon, when these things, the times they don't work, it's so, so frustrating.
Much.
It's so frustrating. And it's funny because, Upton, he has an Echo. And so I was
He
has an Echo.
Okay.
And I went over to his house and he's like, oh man, it's amazing. You know, because he has all the setup. He has like the Nest and
and
the video cameras and the, which I think is Google. But anyway,
Nest is Google.
He's into all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And he's like, man, it's just life changing.
Change your life.
He's like, you need to get one of these. And I'm like, oh, and he's like, he's like, come in here,
And he's trying to demonstrate it.
Yeah. And he's like, in fact, we could probably listen to your podcast. And I'm like, no, don't worry about it. He's like, no. Okay. Amazon or whatever.
Alexa,
let's listen to Psychology in Seattle podcast. We probably sat there for 20 minutes trying to make this thing work. It never worked. And then he's like, okay, never mind that. Name a song. And I'm like, okay, And then I name a song. It doesn't play the right song.
Oh, but you probably picked a really random, obscure
one.
Well,
I don't know what went wrong, but something went wrong there. And then it just proceeded to never really work right. And there were several times when, because you have to say a word to activate it. And sometimes if you don't say something quick enough, it'll turn off. So that it doesn't hear you asking something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's all this fits and starts. Anyway, my point is that All that is annoying me.
You know, I was in a meeting today with clockmakers, and I all of a sudden I got a ding on my watch. I have one of these smart watches, the Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And I look at it, and it's got all the text of what I've been saying for the last, like, I don't know, 3 minutes or 5 minutes.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, but at first.
And it texts it to like someone. Well,
but at first, I don't know. I don't know what I'm looking at. I actually thought I had just received a text message from someone. And you know how you don't necessarily keep every word you've said in the tip of your mind. But when I'm starting reading, I'm like, this sounds so familiar. And I'm like, wait a minute. Has this thing been recording me?
Or did someone just text me exactly the thing
right.
I just said?
So I must have said like, hey Siri, which is going to trigger it. But I must have said that, but not said it. I must have said something that sounded like
right.
it. Like, hey, seriously, right? Like,
right.
hey, seriously.
Right.
And then it started recording. I don't even know what the trigger word would be. If I wanted to have that happen, I don't know how to do it.
Right.
Like if I'm like, oh, I want to record the following really quickly. Hey, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think the only legitimate usefulness is listening to music. I have actually yeah. seen people use it to the if they, but it's like, how hard is it to just, you know?
Well, I will say this: I have an Apple HomePod now. It's their version of the Echo or whatever. Like,
so it's a Siri.
It's a Siri thing. Now, even though Siri in general, I don't use it for my phone and things like that. It sits there on top of my piano. And all I use it for is because I have Apple Music. So I just use it for playing music.
Right.
And I'll say, that's pretty nice. Because I can go, hey Siri, play Beatles, Let It Be. Now, here's where it does get tricky. Because all of a sudden it's like,
which one?
Oh, all right. Well, you know what? I hate this. I was like, hey Siri, play the long and Winding Road. And you know which version it starts playing? The one from Give My Regards to Broad Street. Which is it's not that great.
That's Paul McCartney.
It is still Paul McCartney, but
it's not the Beatles.
But it's not the Beatles. And so then I have to say, play the Long and Winding Road from Let It Be. And you know what it does? It plays Let It Be. So it's still not great, but at least maybe 70% of the time it works for me.
But to me, what I have my setup is I have an iPad that half of its use is this, and it's hooked up Bluetooth to my. A soundbar on my TV.
Yeah.
And so I go to my soundbar, I just hit a button, it goes Bluetooth, and then my iPad has Spotify.
And then you just use that.
And then I just click on that and boom, and I have all my playlists on there cuz sometimes I don't know if I just off the top of my head think, "Well, what song do I want to listen to right now?" I'd really be limited. But when I see it on Spotify or I have a radio station on Spotify, it's like, anyway, my point is that there are other ways.
You're not thinking this through, because imagine you have a really heavy lift day, and the next day you're lying in bed, you can barely move your arms. Yeah. What are you going to do then?
Yeah, that's true. All right, so before going to the break, I just want to rattle off some of the... I don't know why I have this thing. I just like talking about recent movies that I've seen.
Okay.
And I know we just talked about this last week, but I've seen a lot of movies.
Oh, since last week?
Since last week, yeah.
Oh my God.
Like, for instance, I saw Unsane... which is a new movie by Steven Soderbergh.
Unsane. What?
And people have been asking us to talk about it because it's about a woman, Claire Foy, the Queen Elizabeth from The Crown, is breaking out from her role.
Okay.
And she's in this movie. Steven Soderbergh, you know him.
Yeah.
And it is a movie about a woman. I'll just tell you the kind of the very beginning because it's very twisty. So.
Okay.
And I won't spoil it, but she is at work and she seems to be struggling with some mental issues of various kinds. And then she goes to a therapist at a new town, I think, because she moved for a job.
Okay.
And then she just wants to talk with a therapist, but somehow people are misunderstanding her, and what they think is that she wants to be hospitalized or that she needs to be hospitalized. So then they basically forcibly hospitalize her.
Holy shit!
And she's like, I need to get out of here.
Oh my God.
And then like from there, but you don't know, is she actually mentally ill?
She is mentally ill. Yeah.
Or is she completely sane?
And they're victimizing
her. Yeah. And because you could kind of get a little batty if you're sudden, you know. So that's the conceit at the beginning.
Oh, dude, I totally want to watch this. It's called Unsane.
Unsane. And it takes a lot of twists, which I think are quite satisfying. I give it 7 out of 10.
Is it done? Is it a one shot or is it a series?
Just a one shot.
Okay.
Yeah. And I thought it was pretty good. It got pretty good reviews.
It's a movie, you said.
It's a movie.
Is it in the theaters?
Yeah, it just came out in the theaters.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about, I mean, the thing I guess I'll say about the movie is that I gave it some thought, and I actually want to talk with Michael Drain from the Unpopular Culture podcast, because he actually worked in facilities like this, and I never have. But from my impression of these kinds of facilities is that it's a possible situation for someone to be falsely, so to speak, imprisoned in a institution for a brief amount of time.
Yeah.
One, insurance doesn't pay for things forever. And two, there are laws in every state about how long you can involuntarily detain someone who doesn't have any signs of being a harm to themselves or other people. So I will say that the movie, in some way, it could... everything that happened... At first, when I got done with the movie, I was like, there's no way that would happen.
Okay.
But then I thought, it's like, well... It could happen, because essentially, well, I won't spoil it.
I'll watch it and we should talk about it.
Okay.
What if I have a homework assignment?
Yeah. I watched Downsized.
Yeah.
Matt Damon. He gets small.
Yeah.
It got bad reviews.
It did, yeah.
But I liked it. I gave it a 6 out of 10. The setup is amazing. I really loved the first half.
Yeah.
The ending, though, was so quick.
Oh.
It's just didn't really seem to resonate with me. It's almost like they didn't know how to end it, or they didn't know how to set up the ending. But I thought it was really great. There's some questionable racial issues in the movie, because there's this Vietnamese woman immigrant who has a very pronounced comical accent in some ways. But as an Asian person myself, it didn't bother me, but I could see how some people would be put off by it, being like, is this insensitive to Vietnamese people? But, and I suppose it could be in some ways, but anyway. Saw Isle of Dogs. Have you seen it?
It's out?
It came out, 2 days
ago. No way!
I saw it opening night, yeah.
What'd you give it?
You know, I gave it 7.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I will say that several Wes Anderson movies, I have to watch a second time in order to fully appreciate. Like even like Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah.
The first time I watch any Wes Anderson movie, I'm so kind of like overwhelmed with the stimulation that I don't really know what to pay attention to.
I see.
And so I need to watch it again. But well, I think that the look of it is amazing. It's kind of unique for Wes Anderson because it's set in Japan.
I wonder if this is what happened with me and the Amazing Mr. Fox, that remember you and Mitch were like, oh my God, it's so great. It's so great. And then I watched it. I was like, oh, that's pretty good.
You need to rewatch it again.
Maybe it's because I need to rewatch it again.
So I rewatched it in preparation for Isle of Dogs on, the night before.
Yeah.
And loved it even more on a fourth or fifth time watching
it. I'll watch it. Because, I mean, I will say, it was love at first sight for me with the Royal Trinity.
With Rushmore, Bottle Rocket,
and the Royals.
And Royal Tannenbaum.
Yeah, those three
were,
I didn't have to, it was like, I might have to watch that again.
Right. I mean, even Life Aquatic, I had to watch a couple times to appreciate. Darjeeling, definitely second or third time, I liked it better. The first time you and I saw Darjeeling together, and I remember just being I don't know about this one.
Although Moonrise Kingdom, I did like right off the bat.
Totally. Yeah. And the Grand Budapest Hotel, I've only seen that once, by the way.
Me too.
Yeah. But anyway, the problem with Isle of Dogs to me is the story. It's the story. It's the ending doesn't, I don't know, just lacked something.
Okay.
And because normally in a Wes Anderson movie, like in Moonrise Kingdom, it's sort of epic.
Yeah.
You know, and you really feel for Sam and
right,
that you really want them to get married, so to speak, and you know there's a goal, but in this one it just, I don't know, it didn't really deliver in that way.
Oh.
Plus, and people are talking about this, is that Wes Anderson has sort of a track record of not being the best white person when it comes to this sort of thing.
White person?
Well, because he has a lot of token.
Oh yeah, yeah, he always does. Yes,
people of color. You know what I mean? He'll often have like an Indian, right. Like,
and they're usually comedic relief
and servants. Yes. You know, and although I'm sure Time won't, you know, do well with those kinds of things.
But
I've never been like super put off, because to me, I guess I'm just an apologist for Wes Anderson on some level, but also, I feel like he could just completely not have any characters of color in his movies. You know what I mean?
Well, I also always felt...
And in the Grand Budapest Hotel, like the main guy is a person of color.
I always felt, and I could be wrong about this, but I also felt he was going for this like 1920s pulp like right. sensibility.
Right, exactly. But imagine if he went further back and had black people.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Like, no, you're right. I could see how it's difficult, but... But, you know, yeah, but it's sort of like, can you not make, oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
There's some problems.
There are some problems.
And he's from the South, so it's not like, it's not,
I see.
You know, it's not
I've never
like,
thought of that, but you're right.
It's a little problematic.
Yeah.
To me, it's not horrible. This movie is being attacked for those reasons by some people. I'm a Japanese person.
Yeah.
And none of it bothered me at all. Okay. And I'm really curious what Japanese nationals will think of it. But there was one thing that bothered me, in that basically there are two lead characters. There's a Japanese boy mm-hmm. who speaks Japanese the entire movie.
And the dogs speak English, right?
And the dogs speak English.
Yeah.
And the boy's name is Atari, which is interesting.
Right.
Which I don't even know if that's a first name, by the way.
Isn't Atari war or something?
I don't know. I don't know enough Japanese to know that. But the other lead character is a girl voiced by Greta Gerwig, who is a white foreign exchange student. From the previews, I thought she was a Japanese albino girl.
Okay.
Because I was like, oh, it's set in Japan. Oh, that girl, it's the girl with, I don't know if you've seen it, but she has a big white sort of fro.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's funny. They made an albino girl, mm-hmm. you know, because you can have albino Japanese people.
True.
But they made her an American, and she's like kind of like the savior of the whole Japanese culture.
Oh.
And she's an American exchange student.
Weird.
You know? And it's like, you made a movie. You did so many things, Wes Anderson, to make this set in Japan.
Right.
To be an homage to Kurosawa, to the right. art, to anime. And then one of them, in fact, Atari, the Japanese kid, in some ways is secondary to this girl. And it's like,
that's
why
odd.
Not just make her Japanese? Like, why did you have to make her a white girl? Like,
right.
She's.
Just turn her Japanese.
I think she's the only white person in the entire movie. Do
just
you know
turn
what I mean?
Her Japanese.
Right.
I really think so.
Right. Fantastic Mr. Fox, like I said, I watched it again, and I raised it from a rating of 8 to a 9.
Oh.
I think some Wes Anderson movies just get better
with age.
I watched Wind River with Jeremy Renner and the Olsen younger sister, and it's about, and this is, you talk about cultural appropriation, it's about Jeremy Renner, white guy.
Remind me who that is?
He's the archer.
Eagle Eye, the,
yeah.
What's his name?
Yeah. Arrow guy. Yeah.
Arrow guy.
And
this is the episode, the psychology of Arrow guy.
Well, he's the useless Arrow guy in the Avengers. I mean, you have you know, Vision, who can literally change reality.
Right.
And you got a guy with a bow.
Right. You know?
Anyway, so...
Hawkeye.
So Jeremy Renner is a hunter in an Indian reservation area.
Okay.
Like in the Midwest somewhere, I think. And he is friends, and because he married a Native American woman.
Okay.
But they're divorced now. And there's a murder. So it's a murder mystery kind of cop procedural kind of thing. And then the Olsen girl is an FBI, a young FBI agent.
Oh, it's one of the Olsen twins? Like from
one of the younger one. right? Isn't
yeah,
she an Olsen girl?
Twins.
No, no, no. There's the twins, and then there's their younger sister.
Well, then it's not an. Oh, wait, they had sisters.
Yeah. Oh. Anyway.
Okay.
So, she, you know, super white blonde girl. She is an FBI agent. She comes on the reservation and proceeds to take over the investigation. Meanwhile, the Native American police are completely ineffectual, and requires this white hunter guy and this white FBI agent.
How does this get approved these days?
I don't know. I have no idea. And it's so overt. It's almost like a parody of this kind of
right. Because like okay, so I don't think every movie has to be like, you know, one way or the other, but every movie is one way, but they're still the same way.
And you want to? They clearly wanted to make a movie about a reservation because there's a lot of Native American culture presence. You know what I mean? And I will say that it actually won some Native American like an Oscar award. So it's not like Native Americans universally hate the movie. Okay. Do you know what I mean? But you clearly wanted to make a movie about Native Americans. Why do you need two white people to be in there? You know what I mean?
Like, but why do they have to be the protagonists?
Why not? Well, the whole thing is like that the Jeremy Renner character, there's nothing about him that needs to be white.
Right.
And the FBI agent, there's nothing about her that needs to be white either. She could have been anything. You know what I mean? Like, anyway. So now, if it was just one movie and
that's what I'm
thousands
saying.
Of others, but when you see this happen again and again, and you're a person of color like us, it's just like, come on.
That's what I was saying. If it was like it's not Emma, that every movie has
Emma
to
Stone
be.
Is Asian in Hawaii in that Cameron Crowe movie. It's like, come on. It's like, anyway, watched, but I gave it a 5. At first I was like, oh, this is kind of good. 7. And then I was like, 2. And then at the very end, I was like, it has this really great shootout scene in the end.
Okay.
Kind of got out.
Anyway, got to 3.
I texted you. I rewatched Mother.
Right. Mother!
And I originally had it at a 7, and I bumped it up to an 8.
Nice.
I think it's, if you like this movie, I think it's rewatchable.
Oh, I watched it twice in the theater. I certainly will watch it again. Will watch.
Watched Despicable Me 3. Came out last year.
What? 3?
I love all these Despicable Me movies, but the Despicable Me 3, aside from the first 20 minutes, it's okay.
Okay.
But they have the best villains in this series.
Wait, which is the one where it was his brother or something?
So that's 3.
That's 3.
Yeah. So the story's kind of a mess.
I see.
It's like, okay, well, you need to have your cute minion story and you need to have your Gru story. And there's too many stories.
Is the second one Minions or is Minions its own movie?
No, the second one you might not have seen or remember, but he meets a woman.
Well, I don't think I've seen any of them.
Oh.
I might have seen the first one.
They're all the first one is great and the Minions movie is great.
I didn't see the Minions
movie. The Minions movie is legit. It's funny. Yeah, it's good. And I'm watching right now, I have it paused in the other room, The War of the Worlds from the 50s.
Oh, the OG.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that on TV when I was a kid. Like in Colombia, they played it.
It is interesting to see, you know, because, you know, I told you I watched Forbidden Planet and like it totally explains Star Trek. And this is another thing of that. Like there's sound effects that Star Trek, the original series, stole from War of the Worlds. Yeah.
I could see that.
And you know, like when in Star Trek with Kirk and Spock and they would shoot something with their phaser or someone would get shot and it would glow and then disappear.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's like you're shooting someone with a laser and it only affects the person.
Right.
And their clothes,
yeah,
and they grow red hot, and then they disappear. And there's this, you know, like how does that work? Like you have a ray that somehow infects the clothing and the being, but doesn't actually do anything to the surrounding area.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's directly from War of the Worlds.
Wasn't it supposed to be that it gets hot or something?
Yeah, I guess. But if it's that hot, it's like it would go through you. You know what I mean?
Right. And certainly set you on fire.
It would set you on fire. It wouldn't cause you to grow like glow and then disappear.
Well, to be fair, we don't have that technology yet, yeah. Kirk, so we don't know.
So War of the Worlds, it's exactly that. So I think when Star Trek came out, they're like, let's do that, because that was pretty cool.
When Roddenberry was like,
Yeah. Anyway, so let's take a break. When we get back, let's continue this, I'm sure, bothersome episode to the listeners. All right, we're back from the break on this 700th, I almost said 200th, on the 700th episode of Psychology in Seattle. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast yet, what's wrong with you? You need to do it. Go to your computer or your phone, go to patreon.com, become a patron, and you get access to our premium episodes that are only available to Patreons or to patrons. And if you have trouble with the feed, email me at contact@psychologyinseattle.com and I can usually help you. Also, remember that our 10-year anniversary show is on August 11th, 2018. Details pending.
TBD.
Also, buy my book called Multi-Role Clinical Supervision. I'm working on an audio book for it, so be on the lookout for that.
Are you narrating it?
Yep.
Nice.
And it is hard, man. Like, to read a book in a way that doesn't sound weird.
Are you telling it like a children's story? And then, when you see your client, make sure to smile.
So I have another gripe.
All right.
It's a short one. All the different cell phone connectors that exist.
Oh, yeah.
Cause like,
it's not a small one, actually.
Because, like, I mean, it's starting to get better now because all of Android are going to the USB-C. But for a while, last year...
Jesus, dude.
So Pixel was the first to do the USB-C.
Right. So while that was happening...
So I was the... I had a connector that no one else was using.
You had like micro USB or right?
Or iPhone. Right.
Or iPhone, right?
Right.
And iPhone. And this was, what was the version where they got rid of the headphone plug? Was that this version?
So Pixel 2 doesn't have a headphone plug.
Okay.
And iPhones no longer have headphone plugs. Yeah. So, which I sort of get. I mean, and I'm a Bluetooth user now anyway.
Well, so. I am now. I finally gave up. Like, for the longest time, I didn't want to put Bluetooth on my head, and I finally gave up.
Yeah. I find it to be pretty reliable.
It works pretty well, although every now and then it gets stuck where it won't play the audio, and then I'm, like, pressing the button, and it won't go, and I'm, like, press the button, and then I have to put them back in their little stupid case, wait, take them back out, and then it works.
Yeah. Tell me about it. And then you have Bluetooth in the car. Do you use Bluetooth in a car?
Yeah. No, I stopped. Now it's only a USB connection. Because I stopped
that
using
work,
Bluetooth.
Does that work all the time?
In one of my cars, it works. In the other one, it works. Well, you know what happens, right? It auto plays the first thing every time.
Yeah.
And the first thing is now, luckily, the Beatles narration. So it always starts with the because music, so that's not so bad.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a listener who I don't actually have his name written down, so I apologize. But he wanted us to talk about Seattle grunge scene back in the day.
Ooh.
And he wrote, in the episode on Chris Cornell, you were reminiscing about growing up during the grunge era of Seattle in the 90s. To me and to many others who were not there during that special period in time, it seems like that Seattle during that time was the cultural epicenter of all that was cool in the world. What was it like growing up during the grunge era of Seattle? Did it feel magical? Did it feel like you were part of an important cultural moment? I am planning to visit my friends in Seattle in April, and I hope to visit the Museum of Pop Culture and see the Nirvana exhibit. Why do you think Nirvana was the band that really changed rock and roll during that time? What was so special about them? Did you ever see them live? Why do you think Kurt Cobain has become such an icon, almost a spokesman of a generation? He almost seems to be like a John Lennon-like figure for that era. What do you think it is about him that appeals to so many people, including people who were not even born before he died? Berto, what do you think?
Oh, great questions. I love it. First of all, I have sort of a little bit of a different take about the grunge scene. I had just moved up from Columbia. The year was 1990. and I just started school in Tacoma.
In high school.
In high school, yeah, 10th grade. And I remember a couple things. First of all, I certainly was not in it early. Like, I didn't know Mudhoneys and all these other early bands or whatever. I just knew top 40 radio. That's all I knew. And I move up here, and I'm starting to learn a little bit about new wave music. Because
right. You didn't even listen to Depeche Mode.
I did, because they played it on the radio, but I didn't know who they were. I didn't know their name. I didn't know who was in the band or anything. So what happened is my friend Ron, who was on the same school bus as me, we became friends, and we were talking music, and he's like, "Do you like Depeche Mode?" And I'm like, "I don't know." He's like, "You don't know Depeche Mode?" And then he would play me songs. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I know these songs." And the same thing, he's like, "Do you like Erasure?" And I'm like,
so this is in 1990?
1990, yeah.
Interesting.
So, like, Violator had come out, right? So
yeah.
All right, so I was into that music. In the meantime, I remember clearly there was this thing happening. There were some kids at school that were straight edge, and they were getting into this, like, music they were calling grunge or something. And there were these other kids that were not straight edge. They were more, they were wearing the flannel, in fact, and all these things. And they were getting into this thing called grunge. But specifically, they liked this band called Pearl Jam. And they liked this local band named Seaweed. And they talked about, I don't know if I had heard about Nirvana yet, but they were talking about different bands. I immediately had a negative reaction towards this because I don't like scenes in general. And plus, the word grunge put me off. I was like, grunge, that sounds dirty. I don't like that. And then I saw the album cover for Pearl Jam's 10, and it bothered the shit out of me. First of all, I'm like, Pearl Jam, that sounds disgusting. And then I see these people high-fiving, and I'm like, what? This looks terrible. It's like some college kids high-fiving. I don't want any part of this, right? I hadn't heard a single song. I just didn't want to deal with it. And I had really strong negative reaction against it. Now, I remember the day where I'm listening to the radio, and it's the top 40, and they say, oh, the King of Pop has been dethroned this week by this new song from a little Seattle band. And then all of a sudden, they play it. And I'm sitting there listening, and all of a sudden, the speakers explode, basically, with sound. And I remember when the song was over, I immediately called my friend Ty Verzoni. You've met Ty.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did you hear that song? And we were like geeking out over it. And the next day we couldn't stop talking about it.
Where did you hear it?
On the radio at home. I was like listening to the top 40, and it had just beat Michael Jackson for the number one spot.
Oh.
It beat Black or White.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this is different. I had never heard music like that.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was the beginning of me second-guessing my hatred of grunge. I was like, well, maybe this isn't so bad. And then slowly but surely, I started listening to Pearl Jam. And then I was like, okay, maybe this isn't so bad. And I eventually loved Soundgarden. There's some bands I still never got into. But yeah, I eventually came to like it.
Interesting. For me, I grew up in outside of Seattle in the 80s, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes or something. And would go into Seattle to see music occasionally.
Yeah.
Well, let me go through his questions like one by one.
Yeah.
So he asked, did it feel magical? Did it feel magical to you? I mean, you were in Tacoma.
It was the opposite. It felt annoying.
But like once you were fully on board and liked it.
No, I gotta say, because even with the new wave stuff, like, I hated the gothy thing. Like, I just never liked scenes.
Okay.
I still don't. And so, I didn't nothing of it felt magical. It's just that the good songs and the good bands, like always, I liked because I liked music.
Okay. So, yeah. It wasn't, yeah. To me, I would say, yeah, it absolutely felt magical. I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit on, because my friend Chris File, do you remember him? He listened to heavy metal and like punk and stuff, and there was like a sort of deep radio station that would play heavy metal, and he was like, oh, listen to this is a Seattle band called Nirvana,
and they played Bleach or something,
and no, they played Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Okay.
Because Smells Like Teen Spirit didn't become popular for a while.
Yeah.
It was like months. Like,
it was like 91 when it hit, right?
Around there, yeah.
Yeah, 91.
And he's like, oh, this band's from Seattle. And I was like, wow, it's, That's because whenever anything happened, because back then nothing ever came out of Seattle. No. Like barely anything. We had Warren Moon, we had Heart, we had Queensryche,
those are pretty good.
we had the Kingsmen. We had
you're disproving your point.
we had Deer 23, the Posies,
but Queensryche had like one hit.
Yeah, among heavy metal people, yeah. Right. And Heart was mainly 70s, yeah. And blah, blah, blah. And most people didn't think of Heart as a Seattle band.
There was also no scene.
Right. And you had Jimi Hendrix, and you had...
It's like some bands came from Seattle, but yeah. There was no scene.
Right, exactly. Well, there was kind of a scene in the 60s, but very small. Anyway.
Right.
So he's like, hey, this band's from Seattle. And I was like, oh yeah, I've seen their posters because I had they're walking around because at this point I'm in college,
right?
And I'm actually living in Seattle at this point.
So you are seeing posters,
and I'm in the university district, which yeah. There's tons of alternative rock stuff yeah. around. People would play in the university district at college parties and right. stuff. Anyway, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. But I didn't really take to the song. I just thought, like, okay, that's great. Because I was more into, yeah, like Depeche Mode, the Posies and this kind
of stuff. The Posies played at UW when I was there.
Yeah. So when I saw at Bumbershoot one year, this is before Nirvana, I saw Soundgarden play and the Posies opened for them.
Oh, wow.
So... And the crowd was not pleased with the Posies in the front because I was in the back, but the moshers up front were like, get off the stage. And at some point, the Posies were just like, look, the longer you like yell at us, the longer we're going to stay on stage.
So they sing I Can Dream All Day, isn't that one?
No, that was before that came out. So that album came out in response kind of to the grunge. That's a much more grungy album. Okay. But previous to that, they were much more Beatles-y sounding. Anyway. So I think, okay, there's this band. But, to me, Mudhoney was much bigger. Mother Love Bone was much bigger. There were bands that were much bigger in terms of that scene of right. Seattle. But I never in my wildest dream would I think that anyone would pay attention to it.
Sure.
Every town has a set of shitty bands that some people know about.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And so that's what I thought Nirvana would be. But then this is before it's number one. So this is well before the nation or the world knows about it. I'm at a dance club downtown that doesn't exist anymore. And, it's playing CNC Music Factory and this is back when people actually just had records and they would just play a song and then they'd have another song and they'd have a record.
How did they mix between the two?
They would sync it with the beat.
What?
But anyway, and, me and my friends were on the dance floor and we're dancing to all the regular dance hits. And then all of a sudden, just like you said,
dan, dan, dan,
dan, dan, dan, dan, and like, I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Oh.
The entire room
explodes.
Cause I was like, this is from that Seattle. Yeah. This is from that Seattle band.
Yeah.
And I looked around the room and it's just filled with like 21-year-old, 22-year-old people. And we, as an entire collective, just went
nuts,
crazy.
Oh my god!
And there's only one way to dance to that song.
Sure,
it's just bouncing up and down, and like bobbing your head.
Yeah.
And it was at that moment that collective, because I'd heard the song, I'd sort of liked it, but to see that effect it had on me and my fellow Seattleites, and at that point, I just thought, well, that's an interesting phenomenon. That'll never happen again because what DJ is going to play a rock hit? Like that was sort of a one-off thing. Kudos to you, DJ, for being on the cutting edge of that kind of thing. That'll never happen again. and then it started to take off into the charts and people started actually listening to it.
Right.
And at that point, I was like, wow, and then And because I never really liked Nevermind. I mean, I liked it okay.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, it Smells Like Teen Spirit's a great track. But I don't think I ever owned the CD. You know what I mean? I was much more into Smashing Pumpkins, the Gish, Siamese Dream. I liked Mudhoney probably better than Nirvana. And really, the way that this patron is writing in, he makes it seem like the grunge scene was Nirvana.
But it became, for the rest of the world, it became Nirvana.
Kind of. But to Seattleites, Nirvana was just one among, you know, a dozen bands that we considered to be quote-unquote grungy.
Yeah, no, I get that. I just mean, like, even in Colombia, like, everyone knew Nirvana.
Right. So, but to us in Seattle, it was not that way.
Yeah.
We understood that the world was responding to Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder, but we listened to deep Soundgarden, because I've been listening to Soundgarden way before. I was listening to Soundgarden in like 87 or something, you know what I mean? And
I honestly think, though, because he asked one of the questions, like, why Nirvana so popular? Like, Nirvana had super catchy songs.
Right. So the reason why Nirvana really stuck out was because Kurt Cobain purposely wrote songs that would be catchy. Yeah.
Nursery rhymes.
he knew that. He's like, if you want to be popular, and he wanted to be, he's a very interesting dichotomy between desperately wanting to be popular and desperately not wanting to be popular.
Tortured artist, but desperately wanting to be popular.
Right. But he's in interviews talking about how you need to write a song that you can sing like a nursery rhyme.
Yeah. Where the words are really unimportant.
Yeah. And the night comes and it's dangerous and you're now entertainer. Like, it's that needs to be very simple.
Row, row, row your boat. Like, literally. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think his songwriting is amazing given the style that they limited themselves to, because it's just basically rhythm guitar, shitty bass lines, and amazing drums.
Amazing drums.
You know, like pretty rudimentary bass lines, pretty rudimentary guitar for that
matter. Like, it even Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's like, you would think, it's like, oh, that's so perfectly crafted. And I guess it is. But to me, the most perfect craft about it is, one, the changes from quiet to loud. Yeah. That was just a great mechanic. And the drums.
Right.
The drums are glorious.
Yeah, you never, at the time, I didn't appreciate how important David Grohl was to the band. Until you actually listen to Foo Fighters and stuff, and you're like, oh, man, David Grohl is...
added a lot.
Is a genius.
Now, of course, that voice of his, Cobain's voice...
Totally.
Sold the emotion.
Right. So you match up... So basically, you had just like... You had a guitar that sounded garagey. You had bass guitar that sounded garagey. Right. And then you have this voice that's just... Especially on that first Nevermind album, is so just... perfect, because, you know, you can have punk voices that sound punk, but they're not very appealing.
That's right.
And then you can have like Engelbert Humperdinck, which is appealing,
right,
but it's has no punk. Yeah. And he has that perfect kind of, and then you add in the drums and like everything works. I want to give some more context, because I think it is kind of interesting to talk about, is that at the time, you actually are talking about everything that I hated about pop music at that time, because you're like 4 years younger than me.
Yeah.
And so you're 10th grade, you're all top 40.
Yeah.
I'm in college, and all I can do is hate top 40 music.
But you probably hate it started even in the late 80s, because we've talked about this.
Right.
You stopped liking like 88, maybe?
Right. So I looked up different like top 100 hits from the late 80s and early 90s. And you got stuff like Michael Bolton. you have Richard Marx.
Oh, man.
You have New Kids on the Block. You have Milli Vanilli.
Oh. Girl, you know it's true.
You have Bryan Adams during his
Wait, what's wrong with Bryan Adams?
Well, his ballad days.
But that's a good song.
You have CNC Music Factory. Now, I had the CD for CNC Music Factory.
You did?
It has some bangers on it, but you know, Color Me Bad, Celine Dion.
Color Me Bad.
Vanilla Ice, okay?
Ice.
So
baby.
These are, you know, these are not, and then on the, so that was just the top 40 side, but then on the rock side,
You had
Def Leppard during their worst years.
Poison.
You had Poison, right? And you had Motley Crue when they had completely sold out, you know what I mean? And you just had like hard...
The only good stuff still happening was actually Guns N' Roses.
Right. So, well, when Guns N' Roses
and
came
Metallica,
out...
I suppose.
When Guns N' Roses came out, they were kind of the the bridge between metal and grunge.
Yeah.
Like when Guns N' Roses comes out, Jane's Addiction is another band.
Yeah.
So those two bands, they took hard rock and they made it alternative and artsy.
Right.
And gritty, and they didn't care about, you know, the sort of glam side.
Right.
And the top 40 side that Motley Crue and Poison and all those.
And yet
other.
They had more top 40 hits.
Right. And so so that's a definite bridge.
Yeah.
Like when the first time I heard Smashing Pumpkins, I was like, oh, they're just copying Jane's Addiction.
You know what I mean? See.
Which is, they're nothing like Jane's
right,
Addiction.
Nothing like
but that. At the time, it was a step in that direction.
Oh, it's interesting because when I heard the name Smashing Pumpkins, I also wanted nothing to do with it because I thought, oh, they're part of that grunge scene. I don't like that. And it was both Shun and my brother that finally got me to listen to Smashing Pumpkins.
When Gish came out, it was life altering to me. I listened to that album a billion times. Like I just couldn't get enough of that album. Anyway, so that's the setting. Okay, you got right. top 40 and then really, really weak heavy metal music.
Right.
And like everything is plastic. Nothing is real. Everything is fake. Everything is commercial. And everything is electronic, like
electronic drums, electronic keyboards, electronic guitars.
Right. Even major rock acts were using electronic drums.
Yeah.
Because it was like, well, that's what you
cheaper,
need.
Cheaper, it's quicker.
You need that boom, ching, boom, ching. Like everything was fake.
Yeah.
And at the time, I really felt that. And so I would seek things out that were like Husker Du and early REM, like Murmur and things that were real. Mm. And you know, Uncle Tupelo and what's the band from the Midwest? Anyway. There were things that were real that everyone in college was sort of seeking out.
See.
Or going way back to like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, because you had to go way back to find something that felt legitimate and real and not commercial and not electronic.
Yeah.
And this is what Nirvana and Pearl Jam capitalized on.
Right.
They come out with something that's top 40, but is real.
It's real, yeah.
And it feels real. And the way they talk is real. And their hair doesn't have any product in it. You know what I mean? And their clothes are crappy. And they're giving off this air of like, I don't care.
I don't care.
The other thing was that it felt very home to me because the way that Kurt Cobain dressed, particularly in that Smells Like Teen Spirit video, was the way me and my friends dressed.
Right.
Because we would go to Value Village because we didn't want to dress like the man.
Oh.
And we couldn't afford clothes.
Interesting.
So we would just go to Value Village, which is a thrift store.
It's just funny because just 2 years later, the grunge look was in, and then you could go to Nordstrom's and Eddie Bauer and Bon Marché to buy the right clothes.
And so there's a number of things that he's wearing in that video that me and my friends wore just out of sort of necessity. His jeans had rips in it because you just didn't have better jeans. You wore cheap Converse or cheap tennis shoes. And then when you wanted a sweater, because you always need to layer in Seattle because it's always, you never know
it's
if
cold
it's
cold and rainy.
You never know what it's going to be like when you're walking around. So you always need layers. I always talk about layers in Seattle. And one of the things that Value Village had a ton of was cardigan sweaters.
Right.
And so me and my friends, you know, the few guys that we would dress, you know, Value Village-y, we had tons of those exact
sweaters.
And so when I saw him, I was like, oh, he's definitely from my people.
Right.
You know what
he's
I mean?
He's not putting on an act.
Yeah. He just woke up like that.
The rest of the world probably looked at it as, that's a cool costume.
Right. And the whole flannel thing, that goes back to like literally lumberjacks and hunters. Like I have older siblings that wore flannel because they were outside a lot.
Right.
You know, the flannel back then was wool and it lasted a long time. And so
whereas I had none of that context. So when I saw people wearing that stuff, and again, it was so because the scene probably started like 88, right? 89. 90.
Hard to define, but
But anyways, I didn't become aware of any of this stuff till 91. And by then, when I saw people wearing flannel and stuff, they were trying to be part of that scene. So I hated like that look.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting your experience, one, because you didn't come from that the way that
no.
It felt like these guys came from my people.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Whereas for you, it doesn't feel like that. Plus, all the people you observed doing it were adopting it.
Yeah, they were younger and were adopting
as high schoolers, yes. Right? Whereas for me, we just continued.
That's how you dressed.
We just continued wearing flannels. Yeah. Like we didn't we didn't stop. You know what I mean? Right. Or start? It's just like right. I'm going to continue wearing the flannel that my mom got me in the 10th grade for Christmas because she knew that I needed a good warm flannel.
part of the thing that happened is when I was in Colombia, the only clothes I would get were my mom would send them. Like so, she would send me new clothes, and. And they were neat. Like, they were like Genera, you know, and OP and...
Well, Genera is a Seattle brand.
Okay. They were nice clothes. But the thing is, they were not common clothes down in Colombia. Mm. And this didn't help my social stratus or whatever.
Like, so you looked like a weirdo?
Not weird. Just like, I had whatever clothes I had. But the kids in my class, most of them had money because it was a private school. And so they would wear... Now, it was a uniform school, keep in mind, right? But they would wear like things that, like the shirt, their collared shirt, because you could buy a white shirt, but it could be different brands or whatever. So they would have a little bit better, and they would have a little bit better watch, and they would have this. And so I started sort of like naturally disliking, like everyone's like, oh, this is the new thing. Everyone's got to get this. Totally. I started naturally disliking it because I actually couldn't get it. Right, like I was like, I can't get it, but not like I did this mental calculus. I'm just looking back and realizing that part of the reason I disliked it so much is because I couldn't be part of it, right? But then over time, I actually started realizing that there were many negatives that came with cliques and scenes, and that was the other thing I saw societally that happened so much in Colombia that these cliques and these scenes would target other cliques and other scenes, and their violence would ensue, right? And so I actually started really not liking that social aspect of like even the jingoistic, like our country, our thing. I started really disliking that because I started realizing, wait, this only leads to sectarianism and violence and dislike of others, of the other. So long story short, all that got triggered for me whenever I would see one of these little music scenes come up. And it was not that consciously I was realizing it, but subconsciously I was like, ugh.
Yeah, I mean, given the context you came from, it should be a little gross to you. So again, I just want to stress to younger people or people who weren't in this scene is Nirvana was just one.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to stress that. They were just one of dozens of bands that we... like. I lived in college, you know, at the time, and people were constantly blasting music from their rooms and, you know, it's just a constant stream of music all the time. And I would say Nevermind was, I don't know, 2% of the time. Maybe even less than that, honestly, because it's not like one of those albums you can really listen to, like, repeatedly.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, like, Pearl Jam 10, you can kind of listen to that more often, mm-hmm. you know. So I just want to stress that Nirvana has become my suspicion. The reason for it is because every era has to have its token survivor, you know, like from the 60s, it's the Beatles, right? But you talk to people who lived through the 60s and they're like, yeah, the Beatles are great, but, you know, I listened to a lot of bands back then.
Yeah, but we can't discount, like, they sold a ton. Their videos were very good. Songs were very catchy.
So did Soundgarden, so did Pearl Jam.
Nah, Soundgarden didn't have as many hits.
Pearl Jam did,
and they survived, but not as well, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Why, though? Because Eddie Vedder didn't kill himself.
Now, that's fair. That is a fair point.
And because Eddie Vedder is just as compelling as a character. He's just as interesting.
Sure.
He's just as good. Do you know what I mean? Like, he is a genuinely good person who has a lot of interesting things to say and is a legit talent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the reason why we're not plastering his face all over the place is because he didn't shoot himself. I am, given my place in Seattle culture, I am 100% sure that Eddie Vedder had killed himself and Kurt Cobain had not. I mean, imagine Kurt Cobain having a later career. You know, he has albums. Yeah. He has albums that don't do so well. He has some tabloid personal problems. Sure. He says some questionable things. Yeah. You know, would we be holding him up the way that we do today? I don't think so.
I you're probably right. I just feel that even before he killed himself, Nirvana was seen by the outside world as the numero uno.
Sure. And you know, that holds a lot for sure. But at the same time, their second album wasn't complete. It wasn't very
their third
well.
Album, you mean?
Their third, well, yeah. After
In Utero, yeah. You mean?
In Utero was not well liked.
No.
You know, and so they were poised to.
But then they did have that Unplugged session. That was
Unplugged.
Very well liked.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I just want everyone to understand that it's, you can focus on whatever you want to focus on, but just understand that as time goes on, we tend to reduce eras to very simple things.
By the way, I remember that both Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins played SNL near the same time frame. I don't remember when exactly, but a few months apart or something like that. And they both sounded terrible.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I saw Smashing Pumpkins during their Siamese Dream tour.
Uh-huh.
And they sounded like, especially
Cobain. His voice.
Not Cobain.
Sorry.
Billy Corgan.
Corgan.
Corgan, his voice was so bad. Yeah. I mean, he has a very fragile voice.
Yeah.
And Nirvana, same thing. Same like thing. I had friends, so I never saw, to answer his question, I never saw them live. But I had opportunities to.
Yeah.
But I never went because they were considered to be very shitty compared to the other Seattle bands.
Yeah.
You know, Tad, Mudhoney, Fastbacks, like these were like legit Seattle bands, Soundgarden.
Right.
And Nirvana was just like, you know, one of the shitty kind of, you know, secondary ones. And so I did see Mudhoney and these other bands and definitely liked them. And I had friends, Chris Huber, right, went to see Nirvana, and they said they saw Nirvana and like several other bands.
Okay.
And they said Nirvana was the shittiest one. So, it took them writing the songs for Nevermind and recording them perfectly and actually getting Dave Grohl into the band. But anyway, I really knew that Nirvana was a phenomenon. Because again, at the time, I'm listening to lots of music. I never ran out and bought Nevermind. I never needed to because it was constantly on the radio and all my friends had it.
You had Siri. And
yeah. And but I did know that, but I didn't really know that Nirvana was such a thing until this legitimate band had broken up in that I sort of knew of through friends. And they had reached out to me since I was a singer guitarist and said, we want to start a band like Nirvana.
Oh.
And so will you come over to our practice space,
uh-huh,
and the three of us will jam. And these were legit. This was a legit bassist and a legit drummer.
Legit musicians.
And I was, you know, like 21 and didn't know anything about, uh-huh, about that kind of music. And I went over and like tried, you know, but I just don't have that kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
And it went nowhere. But like I was asked, please complete our trio and make us into Nirvana.
Into Nirvana.
And the, you know, and again, these aren't, they weren't, they didn't want to do a cover band. They just wanted to do,
yeah,
something like
something
Nirvana.
Like Nirvana. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when you knew, oh, Nirvana is the thing.
Yeah. I was like, wow, like these legit musicians want to basically copy Nirvana. Like that's, yeah, just strange to me.
That is interesting.
You ask a patron, did it feel like we were part of an important cultural movement? Not at the moment, but there were things that happened, like, because in my culture from Seattle, we considered ourselves to be one of the shittiest cities in the nation. Like whenever I would travel and I would say, they'd be like, where are you from? I'm like, oh, from Seattle. They're like, is that Alaska? like that's what they would say.
Yeah.
Or they'd be like, where's Seattle? And I'd be like, well, it's in the Northwest. And it's like, oh, yeah, is it snowy there all the time? Like there was just no awareness.
Concept, yeah.
Yeah. And so, if they did know about us, they were just like, oh yeah, the Supersonics are from there or something, or the Seahawks or something, you know, they just really didn't have any knowledge. And so there was no social cachet to it. You know, you had LA, you had Miami and Louisiana and or New Orleans, and you had New York, and, you know, even Minneapolis was cooler. And anyway, so it was, and then I lived in Ballard, which back then was like the crappiest neighborhood in Seattle, which it has since become one of the cooler ones. Anyway, there was nothing cool about Seattle. And then overnight, suddenly Seattle was not only cool, but the coolest place on earth, to the point where I had friends who went, you know, women who were friends, they come back from LA and they're like, Kirk, you're not gonna believe this. I was out at a club and these guys came up and hit on us, and their opening line was, "We're from Seattle." these LA guys walk up to us in a club and say, "Hey, we're from Seattle."
Oh my gosh.
And since these young women, friends of mine, were from Seattle, they're like, "Oh, well, what neighborhood?" And the guys are like,
downtown.
No. They just said, "Oh, well, you know, Seattle." Because in their head, Seattle is just like
this thing.
Just like one neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like saying, "I'm from New York City." "Oh, you know, what part?" "Oh, you know, New York City.
Statue of Liberty. I'm from the Statue of Liberty."
Yeah. No one says, you know, if you said, "I'm from Seattle," and you said, "What part?" No one would say, "Oh,
Ballard, you know."
Or just, you know, Seattle. Like, no one would say that. You would say, like, the particular neighborhood. Yeah. There's probably, like, 20 distinct neighborhoods in Seattle that you could say you're from. Anyway, so when I heard that, I was like, whoa. When guys are walking up to girls in clubs and their opening line is,
"I'm from Seattle,"
then I was like, wow, something's happening here. Because just 2 months ago, if you said you're from Seattle, they would run away from you. You know what I mean?
Well, okay. So do you remember there was this infamous article that was published where they had all these grunge terms?
Yeah.
Okay. So the gal that worked at Sub Pop that did that as a lark, she spoke at this one event and I saw her speak. And
the backstory is on this is some major publication like Time or someone just called Sub Pop, because Seattle was such a thing.
Yep.
And they just called Sub Pop, which is the label that had Nirvana and other bands. And they were like, "Hey, we want the scoop on the Seattle lingo."
Yep.
And this woman, she's like, "Oh my God, this is so dumb." And so she just made up a bunch of words and then they printed it.
Yep.
And there's like all these like ridiculous, you know, because they're like, you know, "What does grunge mean?" And, you know, and so she just made up all these really funny things.
And so she spoke and she was talking about how it at that time, they even Sub Pop, they had not realized just the extent of what was happening.
Yeah.
But that phone call made her sort of realize part of it. It was, even though she made a fool out of them, but it was really interesting.
Yeah. So for me, I was playing music in Seattle at the time, basically in a what you could call a grunge band. We were a garage band, you know, two guitars, bass, drums, and we were so there I am in Seattle,
and you're just like a cob nobbler.
Yeah, that's one of the words she said.
Yeah.
Is that like a poser or something?
Yeah.
Cob nobbler.
Like, it was like, Seattle was sort of like a harsh realm at the time.
A harsh realm. So, so for me, it was very applicable to my life, because suddenly every band in Seattle had a chance of making $1 million. I went from being in a band in Seattle, and when you're in a band, you know countless other bands, you know what I mean? Because you play shows with other bands. And I went from being, you know, all of us went from thinking like, we'll never go anywhere. Because not only are we not Milli Vanilli, but we live in Seattle. So even if we were Milli Vanilli,
you still wouldn't get picked up.
No one's going to like us. Like, there's nothing, you know, the music scene's in LA, New York, it's not in Seattle. We went from that to suddenly actually having a crack at international stardom, because there were like Nirvana would go to the MTV Music Awards and wear a band shirt for like the Melvins, and suddenly the Melvins would be like gold records all of a sudden.
Right.
And it was, like, oh my God, like all we got to do. And bands left and right were getting signed by major labels. A band that, my band actually felt pity for, Harvey Danger.
Oh, right.
You know, Flagpole Sitta. We felt really bad for them because no one ever came to their shows. Uh-huh. And so we would actually bring them along like a little brother to our shows because we felt bad. Because we liked them. Everyone except for the lead singer we liked, actually. The lead singer we didn't like. But everyone else we loved. And so, and then they got picked up and they had a hit song. And so... So bands were just going left and right, and the other thing that was very interesting for us at the time was that suddenly there were a million venues to play in Seattle, because suddenly you had all these people that wanted to go to a rock show,
right?
You know, whereas just a few years previous, like before Nirvana took off, there were pretty much only like three or four places that you even could play in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
You had the Ditto. You had the OK Hotel and you had Central Saloon and maybe Blue Moon was having bands back then. But you had very few venues. After Nirvana and Pearl Jam, you had, I'm guessing, 100 different venues. There was one venue in Ballard that was, it was a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Called the New World.
New World. I've heard of this place.
Which... It was just a Chinese restaurant.
But they're like, whoa, we should have some grunge bands here.
So they actually bought a business next door and expanded into it and made one of the best stages in Seattle.
I think you told me about this
place. With one of the best sound systems. And it was a Chinese restaurant, okay? And so, you know, and every night you'd have three bands.
Right.
And it was like one of our go-to places that we would play. There was in Pioneer Square... There was an Indian restaurant called India Taj, mm-hmm. and we played there regularly.
had an Indian restaurant.
And off of Pioneer Square, there was a coffee shop called Dutch Ned's that we played at regularly. You
oh,
know what
my
I mean?
God.
Everyone wanted grunge bands to play.
Right.
And so we had so many different places and there were... audiences who would just come to watch shitty bands play.
You know what's so interesting? I started at UW in 93 and I had a shitty band too, right? And it never occurred to us to go try to play a show at a club.
Why?
I don't know. We thought our options were limited to, hey, such and such is having a frat party. They said we might be able to play there.
Yeah.
Or, hey, the Asian community is having an event. We could play there. Or the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers is having an event. Maybe we could play an event there.
Well, I'm here to tell you that's where you played.
Yeah.
You played in the Hispanic.
At the Hispanic Engineers Society.
Oh, my God.
And we actually played Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, there were so many venues, and it was such a great time. There were so many great bands, and so much energy, and everyone believed that they could be big. You know
right.
what I mean? Like everyone was vying to be big, and it felt like a magical time.
Yeah.
So just a little bit more on Kurt Cobain, because I don't feel like I gave him enough credit. I'm a Kurt Cobain nerd. I wasn't back in the day.
Yeah.
But in my older age, I've watched a lot of documentaries, a lot of interviews. There's this one interview with him at the Edgewater Hotel on a balcony that I've watched.
I've seen that one.
I've watched it like five times.
Yeah, it's great.
It's the interviewer is terrible.
Yeah.
But she's so real, and he's great. You know, yeah. Kurt Cobain. He just answers all the questions honestly. Yep. He's kind of funny, and
because the interviewer's trying to force a narrative,
right?
And it is kind of like the grungy narrative, and then he's just like answering, real,
right? And I can't tell you how familiar the way that he is in that interview.
Yeah.
It feels to me because me and all my friends were exactly like that.
Like you knew people just like that,
yeah. And the attitudes were there, you know, because, like I said, because we were so anti-popularity
right.
because we knew we were never going to be popular.
Uh-huh.
That's where that whole thing comes from. Like if you're from a town and from a genre
yeah.
that will never be popular, then you just say, well, fuck it. I don't want to be popular.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to try. I don't.
It's like me with the clicks, with the scenes.
So, and just the way that he talks about things, and like, I should mention Almost Live. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah.
It was like a local Saturday.
Oh, I used to love Almost Live.
Well, all those grunge guys watched that show. They were on the show sometimes.
Because the funny thing is, even though I am younger than you, I moved when it was the height of this stuff. Like,
right.
I remember that very first, maybe it was the second weekend I was here. I got together with these two new friends, and it was Saturday, and they're like, okay, well, tonight, like, we'll watch Almost Live and Saturday Night Live. And I was so confused. I for some reason, I had never heard of Saturday Night Live. Probably because in Colombia, this was not a thing. And so, but they said live almost Saturday. Like, they said so many live words, and I'm like, wait, is this a live event? Are we? It's like, no, it's on TV. Oh, okay, but it's live. And it's like one show or two shows? They're like, no, it's two shows. One is Almost Live, and one's Saturday Night Live. Okay. But it's the same people. It's like, no, it's just one. Like, it was so confusing to me. But I remember we watched them, and yeah, it was awesome. Like, I remember laughing. It was great.
Yeah, they had all these like Seattle jokes and skits and stuff. Kurt Cobain, in his interviews and the way he comes across, he comes across as very real, very honest. He's insecure, and he's not afraid to talk about it. He had a lot of really smart observations of fame, and he was very generous with his popularity in terms of spreading out around the credit and everything. You know, he was a humble guy, very likable guy. So I get now the same can be said for Eddie Vedder, by the way. So it's not like, you know, Eddie Vedder is a great guy. So, but yeah, it was an amazing time. There were so many bands. You had Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Tad, Temple of the Dog, Fastbacks, Mudhoney, Tree People, Soundgarden. All these bands were huge at the time. Yeah. And they were all from my stupid little town. And they were international. Alice in Chains, Mother Love Bone, Screaming Trees, Green River, Melvins, L7, Hazel was a local band. Sleater-Kinney, you know, basically kind of came up. Candlebox, which is a shitty band. But, you know, Hammerbox, good, you know, Kerry Acree.
Oh, Hammerbox, the guitarist from Hammerbox was a coworker of mine a few years later.
That
we worked together.
My guitarist in my band bought his guitar rig. But Kerry Acree, or Acre, I don't know how to pronounce the name. She was a barista in the music building at UW.
Wow.
And so, but this is before the whole grunge thing. You know, so the grunge thing was a local, there was local fame. You know what I mean? We never thought it would branch out from Seattle.
Right.
But so me and my friends would like go to her, her, you know, espresso stand and be like, she's in Hammerbox. She's the singer from Hammerbox, you know? So yeah, it definitely felt like something had happened, but almost as quickly as it happened, it was over. It was like, as soon as, you know, there's a red carpet event and some interviewer shoves a microphone in Sharon Stone's face and says, what's your favorite Seattle band? And she's like, Pearl Jam. And then the next, you know, celebrity comes and they, what's your favorite Seattle band? Soundgarden. You know, I was like, oh, you know, because the whole thing was based on realness and alternativeness.
Plus then you, right around then, you have a second British coming, you know, because you have like Oasis, Radiohead. You have like all these new, like, new bands showing up and a new sound that was trumping what now started feeling like the old grungy sound.
Right. And so it was a blip in time. And we're talking in terms of my life and experience, it was probably like a year, maybe six months where
I remember like mid 90s, what became really cool was like Blur, Oasis, Pulp, all the, you know, like a lot of
Elliott Smith.
Oh, well, yeah. And certainly it varied. Like, it started veering in a few different directions because the part.
Well, and then you got like Massive Attack and.
And the electronic stuff started really coming up too.
Yeah.
But I, like, Elliott Smith to me was sort of like the offshoot of, the Unplugged.
Right.
You know?
Well, he was sort of local.
Yeah.
Portland, you know? And so, but yeah, it was definitely, you know, I can't think of a better time to have been in a garage band other than maybe being in London and Liverpool in the 60s.
Liverpool, yeah.
You know, like to be a singer guitarist in a garage band at the age of 21 and 22, playing at different clubs in Seattle at the height of the grunge era in Seattle with dozens upon dozens of clubs to play in and you know, so many people wanting to listen to that kind of stuff and people just looking at you like you're going to be the next Kurt Cobain.
Right.
Yeah, it was a magical time.
That's awesome.
Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because
dan, you deserve.